Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Mexico's new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who is often referred to as just López Obrador or AMLO, has been a sort of perpetual outsider and critic of the longstanding government consensus in Mexico for years. But he won the presidential election back in July and is going to officially take office this Saturday, December 1st. This all is happening at what you might call an interesting time when it comes to the U.S.-Mexico relationship. So for the rest of the hour today, we're joined by Dr. Rick Coughlin. He is the Associate Professor of Political Science at Florida Gulf Coast University, and he specializes in Mexican politics. Dr. Coughlin, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi there.
If you'd like to add your voice to our discussion, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So I want to start with the basics. Who is Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and what was his path to the presidency?
López Obrador was part of the PRD, which was the party of the left in Mexico that broke away from the official party, the PRI, which was the party that emerged from the Mexican Revolution and governed Mexico from 1928 until 2000. Mm-hmm. In the late 1980s, the hegemony of the PRI began to disintegrate and the PRI splintered. And so López Obrador joined the splinter group that was associated with reasserting economic nationalism in Mexico as opposed to the neoliberal model that Mexico had embraced in the early 1980s in the wake of the debt crisis. So that is kind of the political origins of López Obrador. He comes from the state of Tabasco. He was the governor of Tabasco. He served as mayor of Mexico City from 2000 until 2005, after which he quit, ran for president in 2006, lost a closely contested election where there were many allegations of fraud, lost by less than one percentage point in 2006, ran again in 2012, ran again in 2018, this time winning by an overwhelming 53% in a field of three contenders from the major political parties in Mexico.
Wow, three contenders and you still got 50-some?
53%.
53. That's pretty impressive, especially considering that he narrowly lost by just a percent before.
Oh, well, that's right. So there's been a real collapse in the legitimacy of Mexico's two major political parties, which is the PRI, right, the official party that governed Mexico for
the official left
much of the 20th century, and then the PAN, which was a kind of the right-wing alternative to the PRI that gained the presidency in 2000. The PAN and the PRI essentially agree on economic policies. Both of them favor a policy of economic development by means of integrating Mexico into the global economy and making Mexico into a favorable location for transnational corporate investment. But by 2018, this model of economic development had simply failed to deliver benefits to the majority of Mexicans. And both the PAN and the PRI had become discredited. The outgoing president, Enrique Peña Nieto of the PRI, enjoys a popularity rating, an approval rating now of around 18%.
Oh, that's pretty low. That's not so good. But is that because people are not seeing the economic benefits of those types of policies that make Mexico a global partner?
Well, poverty in Mexico is still, you know, around 43%. And that's in economic good times, right? When there is a recession, you know, the poverty rate can rise to as much as 60% because a lot of people are in the bubble, right, in terms of, being very close to living in poverty.
So why has this global economic model, this idea of being a good global partner and people putting their factories in Mexico, we hear about it constantly up here. How come that hasn't translated into decent wages and people coming out of poverty in Mexico?
Well, Mexico has a gigantic informal sector. Over 60% of Mexico's population works in the informal sector.
You mean under the table?
Under the table, street vending, working in sweatshops, working in criminal organizations, undertaking some form of sexual labor. I mean, these are various manifestations of the informal sector.
Yeah. So I'm not. I guess I'm not surprised. So I guess that leads me to the question of how does corruption and that kind of thing play into this AMLO's rise to his success?
Well, one of AMLO's campaign promises was to do away with corruption.
Is he going to be able to do that? Is that even possible?
Well, that's a huge question, right? Because, AMLO won the presidency, right? And he also won majorities in both the Chamber of Deputies, which is Mexico's House of Representatives, and the Senate, right? So AMLO, unlike his predecessors, doesn't have to deal with divided government, right? His political party, Morena, controls all the major branches of the federal government in
Mexico. So that bodes well for him.
Yes.
However, corruption is, it's a big issue in a lot of countries around the world.
Right, right. Well, to take an example from Mexico, right, if one thinks about the state of Guerrero, which is like a major center of opium production now and heroin, the processing of opium into heroin, it's displaced the Golden Triangle, which was located in northern Mexico. And so the center of heroin production has shifted from northern Mexico to southern Mexico, to the state of Guerrero. One Mexican publication, El Proceso, reports that during the campaign, anybody who wanted to openly campaign for political office had to secure the permission of organized crime, right, in order to be able to move about the state and mount a credible campaign for public office. So in many parts of Mexico, organized crime serves as kind of filter for people to be able to access, the possibility of running for office. So that kind of calls into question, what exactly is the composition of Morena?
Because AMLO had to go through that then. I mean, if he mounted a successful campaign, he was one of the people that had to get permission from this drug cartel?
Well, AMLO was a national figure on the political stage.
So he already had that going for him.
We already had that going. But we're talking about people who are serving as municipal presidents or people who were voted into the state assemblies or people that were voted into the Chamber of Deputies or people that were voted into the Senate, right?
So all the people that are of his party that are now have risen to maybe work hand in hand with him, they're also people who have had to pay off these guys.
Well, some of them, right? You look at his political coalition, right? And, his political coalition is fractured, right? There are lots of members of his political coalition that are from the dying political parties, right, from the PAN and the PRI and the PRD that lost all political credibility over the course of the previous presidential administration and switched parties, right, so that they could continue to have a life in politics.
Mm-hmm. So when we booked you to come on the show, it was several months ago. And since then, we've seen a few things happen, just a couple little things. We have the caravan of people that's seeking refugee status in the United States. It's culminated over the weekend at a border near Tijuana. Lopez Obrador presidential administration change that kind of situation at all?
I don't know. I mean, there was news over the weekend that, Mexico had agreed to basically house people that were petitioning for asylum in the United States and Mexico.
Yeah. And then he came out and said, no, that did
not
really happen.
But maybe there was some kind of transaction happening where Mexico would make concessions on immigration in exchange for the United States making concessions on the North American Free Trade Agreement. That's a little bit murky. It's worth noting that, Mexico's position in relationship to the United States is kind of similar to the position of Turkey in relationship to the European Union, where, Turkey is kind of serving as a warehouse, right, where refugees that would like to emigrate to the European Union are kept, right? And so, this is the role, obviously, that the Trump administration would like to see Mexico play. I think if AMLO were to embrace that, there'd be a huge domestic political cost for him to pay.
Yeah, I'm wondering how Mexican citizens see these people. I was reading earlier today that, lobbing of tear gas at these people at the border and that Mexico would probably not do a whole lot about it because it wasn't targeted at Mexicans. Do you see in the Mexican culture what is their feeling towards migrants that are working their way through?
Well, it's hard to say because on the one hand, there is a certain amount of prejudice that Mexicans have against people from Central America. And there's large-scale immigration of Central Americans through Mexico. The previous administration was committed to deporting many of these, right? So that Mexico has already been kind of serving as a filter that's been holding back a lot of the migration that is flowing through Mexico from Central America. On the other hand, you know, there's a sense of identity, right? That when I was in Mexico recently, people expressed outrage about the migrant caravan, and also outrage about the treatment of migrants, Mexican migrants, and migrants in general in the United States, seeing these migrants as their friends, as their relatives, as people like them. So, you know, I would say that there's a good deal of sympathy that is also intermixed with some degree of disdain for people from Central America.
Or maybe so resentment, perhaps.
Resentment, yes, yeah. Yes.
So I'm wondering, so AMLO's left, right? But the way that his economic posture, the way that you describe it, doesn't sound as left. It sounds a little bit almost nationalistic.
Well, that was sort of the concern with AMLO, right? That AMLO would take Mexico back to the 1970s, right? When Mexico was pursuing this sort of program of economic nationalism that was focused on the state as the sort of the leading, the organizing force in economic development. Mm-hmm. And so there would be economic nationalization, right? The state would nationalize.
Like getting away from that global partner feeling.
Right.
So
right.
If he wants to go if he's kind of campaigned upon the idea of going away from that global thing and going more nationalist, I mean, what does that portend for the future?
Well, he didn't precisely. I mean, he kind of backed away from his nationalist stances as he got closer and closer to winning power in order not to provoke an economic crisis in Mexico. And he's done a good bit of outreach to the business class in Mexico. And so I think he's committed to a program where he's trying to conciliate a number of different powerful interests, right? So that there are popular interests of, you know, wanting to see an end to corruption and impunity, wanting to see alternatives to basically the poverty that exists across Mexico. But, you know, he also, you know, conciliates with the United States, conciliates with the business class in Mexico, conciliates with the Mexican military, and he's trying to find a way forward by means of harmonizing these different interests.
Well, and then over all of that, you have the drug cartels, and these are very powerful groups of people. Has he made any steps towards trying to conciliate with those parts of power?
Well, okay, so his policies against the cartels comes down to several things. First of all, he's proposed a legalization of marijuana.
What would that do to them? Would that take some of the power away from them?
Well, that would take away one of their important markets.
Yeah.
Right. And then the Morena has proposed somewhat ambiguously considering the legalization of other narcotic substances.
Wow.
Right. And so that's part of what he's proposing. Another part of what he's proposing is offering amnesty for sort of low-level criminals that haven't engaged in really violent activities such as kidnapping and murder. You know, within organized crime in Mexico.
Does the United States opioid crisis fit into Mexico's organized crime situation?
Oh, yes.
It's because of the heroin down south?
Right, right. Yeah. So there's significant – I mean, Mexico is the biggest provider of heroin. So, yes, I mean, Mexico is tied to the opioid crisis in the United States. But then again, you have to recognize that, you know, the Mexican cartels also are able to arm themselves through the United States.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean,
it's quite a gross symbiotic relationship.
Right. That's a good way of putting
it. As I put a word on it, I'm just going to go ahead and call
it
gross.
Or peculiar.
Yeah. I mean, it's sad. Why is that able to flourish so well? Is it because the entire economy has been so oppressed?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons why narco-trafficking and organized crime has grown so significantly in Mexico is because of the decline of the official party. Right. So the official party, remember, they controlled Mexico from 1928 until 2000. And for a long time, they controlled all the levers of power. Right. They controlled the presidency. They controlled all the governorships. They always had a majority in the Congress. And they were kind of the glue that held Mexico together, right? And in particular, the pre-work through a politics of clientelism, right, of paying people off and establishing these kind of vertical chains of patron-client relationships. And that was the way in which drug trafficking was kind of incorporated into the state, right? So that drug traffickers, you know, were given what were called plazas within different Mexican cities in exchange for, you know, paying off, officials within the ruling party, right? And so when the ruling party disintegrated, right, that left a huge political vacuum. Mm-hmm. And it was no longer the case that the official party could mediate disputes between these drug cartels, right? And the drug cartels were competing to have access to the primary transshipment routes. And at the same time, drug trafficking through Mexico was accelerating as the United States succeeded in pushing narco trafficking from the Caribbean and South Florida to Central America and through Mexico, right? So there's a kind of convergence between how the United States fought the war on drugs and how the PRI disintegrated as kind of the glue that held Mexico together. And I think much of the drug war stems from the convergence of those factors.
So AMLO thinking about just legalizing all these drugs, that would just take a lot of power away from these cartels. I think that would be – it's kind of a scary risk.
Well, I mean, there are public health concerns, particularly when one goes beyond, you know, legalizing the use of marijuana.
Well, not just that, but then also, well, I mean, would it take down the violence and the kidnappings and the other things that are kind of part and parcel?
Well, that's uncertain because, I mean, one of the things that organized crime has done as the Mexican state has sort of fought the war on drugs since 2006. I mean, 2006 is the year when this conflict, you know, really accelerated and became highly militarized and started generating high levels of casualties. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that narco-trafficking organizations have done since then has been to diversify their portfolio of criminal activities, right, so that they're engaged in
sex trafficking and things.
Pilfering natural resources, that's a big one.
Really?
Extortion, basically sucking resources out of local governments. So in those respects, right, because the activities associated with organized crime have become so diversified, organized crime has become somewhat more intractable in Mexico.
You know, we're running out of time. There's so much to talk about. I feel like we haven't even hardly scratched the surface. And I'm sure you would probably agree.
It's an immensely complex and fascinating country.
It really is. And we're going to have you come back and talk again about this a little bit longer. But that's all the time we have for today's show. So I want to thank my guest, Dr. Rick Coughlin. He's an associate professor of political science at Florida Gulf Coast University. Thanks so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you.
Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.